tune out of the anti-white system and tune in to the pro-white system.
Hello, and welcome to the Daily Nationalist. I wish I could do a better British accent. I really can't for some reason. I could do a good Indian one, though. Today's date is the 2nd of July, 2026, which also blows my mind. I'm going to talk about BRICS today. It is also 96 degrees here in northern Appalachia, believe it or not. The real feel is something like 110 at this point. My people were not meant to live in these temperatures. These are African temperatures. 85 degrees humidity. I'm sorry, 85% humidity. This is an outrage to my very being. It's not the only thing that's outrageous, of course. BRICS, we're going to talk about BRICS as to what it is and what it isn't. The title is BRICS Closes the Books and the West Remains Clueless. Now, closes the books, that's an old mafia term to refer to the fact that they, when at a certain point, the families will not make any new maid members for various reasons. That's what's going on here. Wasn't that long ago, it was June 24th, the 12th Primakov Readings Conference. Russia's foreign minister, as we all know, Sergei Lavrov, categorically emphasized that BRICS, we know what that means, Brazil, Russia, China, India, and South Africa, suspended its future ambitions of expansion, citing divergences and rising perceptions over emerging geopolitical change among members of the BRICS Association. No kidding. I said that a long time ago. I still don't know why South Africa is there. Should note that Yevgeny Primakov, who died in 2015, was both foreign minister and prime minister at a rough time near the end of Yeltsin's sorry rule. And he created something called the Primakov Doctrine, which is still pretty much in force. The national security of Russia relies on its superpower status, and therefore, there can never be a unipolar international order led by the U.S. or anyone else. Some of you might know, I haven't dealt with BRICS in a long time, but BRICS has experienced a tectonic appreciation for its latest expansion from 5 to 10 members. And there's a partner membership for 13 other countries. But frankly, while it was something that they would brag about before, it's an obstacle now. And Lavrov's very clear about this too. A key obstacle. Sharp differences and disputes, tarnishing the image and hindering to some degree the progress of the association. These Primakov readings are extremely important. I don't think I've mentioned them here before, but this is where, you know, certain doctrines are laid out. The elite of usually Russian society. But it was founded to create and intellectually create the groundwork for multipolarity. To fight what we used to call the New World Order, now the Great Reset. But there was this drive to rope in the East and the Global South. Global South is another term for third worlds. I don't like it. And of course, they denounced the so-called rules-based order, the hegemony of the U.S. and the EU. BRICS, of course, comes in for these countries to raise their voice and interaction in multilateral institutions and organizations. I think collectively, they could considerably participate in the rise of a new global age, global stage. But they're strictly in the economic realm. Lavrov reiterated that the U.S., and the West in general, have not accepted the objective reality of an emerging multipolar world order. And this is true. And that causes tremendous cognitive dissonance, and that causes lashing out. To what extent the Iranian debacle has finally drove it home to people. Frankly, right now, the U.S. is a regional hegemon. That makes some sense. And what the U.S. has to do is take its bases home. The Iranians, of course, made that easier, at least in the Middle East, destroying them all. But the regime props up its weakening positions by forcing others to side with them, imposing sanctions, enacting bans, issuing threats. And, of course, importantly, using debt to control the Third World, despite the fact that the U.S. is deeply in debt. The U.S. is so deeply in debt, there's not enough dollars on the planet to pay it. Lavrov went further, though. The West persists in its refusal to abide by the universally recognized international norms set forth in the U.N. Charter. Now, again, don't get all upset. The U.N. is just used as a battering ram against the U.S. The U.S. has never really fully respected it. You know my position on international law. It's absurd. It's a piece of paper. There's no one to enforce it. I don't remember voting on it. Well, I don't vote anyway, but these multilateral institutions that Lavrov is talking about is a weapon against the U.S. Let's keep it like that. Those signing the U.N. Charter need to abide by its rules. You know, the U.S. doesn't care about that. So Lavrov saying that is no big deal. But the U.N. Charter does say that states are the sovereign equality of states and non-interference in domestic affairs. That is important. The U.S. is probably very upset having put that in before. But that is a good concept of it. I mean, let's face it. The last invasion of Lebanon by the Israelis, they attacked the U.N. bases there. A whole lot of people are talking about that anymore. But there still is tremendous potential. New powerhouses in Asia and Latin America. They say Africa, but I'm not so sure. But this is what BRICS was meant to drive. Comprehensive agreement between China and Russia. They were the driving force behind BRICS, the world's, by far at the time, the world's most powerful growing economies. China has surpassed the U.S. both in nominal terms and in PPP terms. And it's more than that because China actually makes things. Russia remains the fourth largest economy in the world, both in a PPP as well as absolute terms. But recently they've wanted to add and bring in more members. Now, of course, way back when, in 2010, they brought in South Africa for some ungodly reason. South Africa sticks out like a sore thumb. The blacks in South Africa, when they took over from the whites, destroyed that country. Anyway, after just 16 years, their membership drive provided to be a big problem. And it can't be managed within the current framework of BRICS. China and Russia, this is a matter of principle. It won't produce any positive results. So let me quote Lavrov here explicitly. We continue to comprehensively develop them while trying to stimulate the trilateral RIC, Russia-India-China group. That format was shaped about 30 years ago, the initiative of Yevgeny Primakov, and formed the core of BRICS. In our associations, cooperation is based on mutual respect and the readiness to search for consensus solutions, even when this is a challenging task. These things happen, and quite often. But the solutions we eventually find are guaranteed to serve common interests. That is why the number of countries willing to join the operations of BRICS and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization keeps growing, namely in Central and Southeast Asia, Africa, and Latin America. Now, let me make a... We're going to have to talk about the different Eurasianist and anti-regime organizations. BRICS, I just described. A long time ago, I did a lecture on the Shanghai Cooperation Organization as very, very important. They are a security group. The SCO just makes more sense. It's made up of China, Russia, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, India, Pakistan, Iran, and Belarus. India and Pakistan. Only Putin could bring those two together. They have interests in common. I know Pakistan and Iran hate each other. I'm sorry, India and Pakistan hate each other, but they have far more to worry about with the West than they have to hate each other over. When the war began with Iran, for example, and Iran's a member, this is what they said in 2025, June 23rd, 2025. The Shanghai Cooperation Organization expressed a serious concern of the growing escalation of tensions in the Middle East, strongly condemns the military strikes carried out by the U.S. on nuclear facilities in the Islamic Republic of Iran on June 22, 2025. Such actions constitute a gross violation of the norms and principles of international law, Charter of the UN, the SCO Charter, prohibits the use of force in international relations. They undermine the sovereignty and territorial integrity of the Islamic Republic, harm regional and international security, and pose serious consequences for global peace and security. The SCO calls for the de-escalation of the current situation in order to seek its settlement through political and diplomatic means. Well, I mean, this is pretty harsh for a diplomatic message, which means that the attitude is far harsher. You know, the word condemn is not used very much. But again, international law, that can't be a reason for anything. Charter of the UN, who cares? Territorial integrity, that's another matter. Posing consequences for global peace and security, that's another matter. That's something that we can actually see. It's not words on paper. But attacks on the nuclear facilities, gross violation, that's what the purpose was. They didn't care if it was in a gross violation of international law. They didn't give a damn about that. They want to kill civilians, and they've been doing it for a long time. The regime states, that is. But they could come up with something like that because of the limits they've placed on membership. Going back to BRICS, during the Primakov readings, late June 2026, they mentioned Yevgeny Primakov himself, who's of course long gone, that he anticipated the evolutionary social development trends during his time in the 90s. Of course, I did as well. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, roughly in 1991, the number of BRICS member states has almost doubled. Primakov had conceptualized the RIC. So it comes out of the late 90s. So while explaining latest developments, that number of full members have increased from 5 to 10, and so Lavrov said the following. This is not how it happened when BRIC accepted South Africa. And the addition of one country posed questions that needed to be clarified to ensure forward movement. When BRICS turned into a group of 10, it was decided to give the new members time to become adjusted to each other. I guess that's the correct decision. During a meeting of BRICS Council of Foreign Ministers in India, discussions were held in practical terms. A difficult conversation between Iran and the UAE during the hottest period in the Gulf confrontation. United Arab Emirates is an Israeli territory, or at least they were. I said a few months ago that they gave the U.S. a certain amount of time to clear out. But he goes further than that. I mean, he talks about, you know, clashing economic interests. You can't connect South Africa with Russia or China, or Iran for that matter. South Africa has turned a first world state into a third world state. And because of this, adding more states with different circumstances has been banned for the moment. Remember, BRICS is not really, they're more like Bilderberg. It's not really an organization. It's an informal association. Now, that might be a benefit. Primakov never thought of it as something rigid, especially a global structure rather than a continental or regional one. And people find this very confusing. It's interesting to note and remind here, in an interview with Sky News Arabia on September 20th, 2024, Lavrov expressed skepticism, but was straight to the point about the strategic expansion of BRICS. Under Russia's BRICS presidency, five countries, Ethiopia, Egypt, Iran, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE, became the second wave of the newest members to join BRICS. Okay. Ethiopia doesn't make a whole lot of sense, although they are in a very strategic position. Egypt is possible, I suppose. Iran certainly fits. And Saudi Arabia and the UAE, in different ways, are pro-American. So it's a Trojan horse. But Lavrov acknowledged in his interview, as well as his speeches, that BRICS is consolidating its positions and cooperating with a number of countries. But there's more serious challenges. If you remember a couple of years ago, I just excoriated BRICS for their very weak statement on international relations. I can't remember specifically, but it was just, well, after their big meeting, you know, they essentially say we're going to cooperate with the IMF and all this. That's not what BRICS is for. Lavrov made it clear it's necessary to promote collaboration based on a balance of interests. BRICS functions on the basis of consensus, which means you have to reflect the mutual accord of all participants. Well, the more diverse the group, the more difficult that's going to be. The more partners, the harder it is to search for accord. It takes more time to finalize any consensus-based agreement than a vote-based solution. Egypt, after Mubarak, is, you know, again, has been driven right back down to third world status. Ethiopia, you could make an argument, it might not be convincing to me. But Saudi Arabia and the UAE, they are, they need to be out. Regardless, according to Lavrov, the BRICS expansion has sparked debates and discussion over this period of time. It clearly has threatened the U.S. He said the suspension of membership into BRICS was based just on these very problems, these internal differences, perception, the approach to geopolitical changes. As stipulated by their own guidelines, there are no real concrete criteria or rules for admission, except using that flexible term consensus, a general agreement at summits, which was utilized in the selection process. Well, we know what the real reason why BRICS exists, and so did Primakov. It's to make war on the liberal West, to create their own banking system, their own set of currencies. United Arab Emirates makes absolutely no sense, whatever's left of it. You know, bringing countries where 10% of the population is citizens, are citizens, or 20% or something like that, is a bad idea just by itself. Now, the Primakov readings in June 2024, the key point was this very suspension of new members. Then, around the middle of the year, mid-June, Lavrov hosted the BRICS Foreign Ministers Council in Russia's Nizhny Novgorod. And there it was formalized. BRICS foreign ministers decided to suspend admission of new membership, and this step reflected in the final documents. The annual agenda is determined by a rotating presidency of BRICS members. And that was Primakov's idea when he first conceived it in 1998. But you can't have your enemies taking over every few years. Now, in practice, so far, every successive presiding country strives to ensure some kind of continuity. So, for example, when India had the presidency, BRICS members have been actively working to implement initiatives which Russia presented during the Kazan summit in autumn of 2024, which many people forget when it comes to understanding India's foreign policy. It's true that many members, many countries are willing to join the group, which by itself, even if they don't get in, and they shouldn't get in, it's still an inspiring fact. One of the key issues here is to ensure the close partnered relationship between Putin and Xi, Russia and China. Quite frankly, they're the only two countries that matter in this regard. India, at least ideologically, is a bit wobbly, but the U.S. has done everything in its power to piss them off. The SCO just seems to make more sense to me, although, again, they're not an economic organization. Then here you have the magazine Bloomberg. God, I'm sick of these people. They published an article, oh, I forget when that was, a couple of months ago, called Iran War Shows BRICS Limits as India Pushed to Choose Sides. Which shows you they still don't know what BRICS is. So you had a false premise in this article. And the false premise is that the supposed importance of BRICS, issuing a joint statement about the Third Gulf War, and the perception that BRICS risks, and this is a quote, by the way, BRICS risks nothing, becoming irrelevant if it doesn't engage with the defining issues of the moment. As defined by whom? That's the issue. And of course, nothing could be further from the truth. BRICS is not a security bloc tasked with addressing, quote, the defining issues of the moment. It's not their job. In fact, another article came out, quote, Russia's BRICS Sherpa, whatever that means, debunked speculation about it turning into a security bloc. That was earlier this year. No, the reality is that BRICS is a voluntary network of countries that share the goal of accelerating financial multipolarity in order to facilitate global governance and its reform for countries that are largely now drowning in debt, to put it mildly. September 2024, someone said BRICS could be compared to a Zoom conference. Members actively participate in talks on the subject. Partners observe their discussions in real time, and everyone else with an interest in them hears about the outcome afterwards. This year's BRICS didn't really achieve anything tangible, all for this reason. And that was fine with all of its members, since some of them are rival pairs who are unlikely to agree on anything meaningful. Will they do in the SCO? Next point. Trying to bring people like the countries like Saudi Arabia and the UAE into it, almost designed to deadlock the organization. Iran and the UAE are enemies. UAE is a partner of Israel. Remember, it's not just that BRICS isn't a security bloc. It's not even a political one. So statements or lack thereof don't make any difference. Now, finally, the third point is that India isn't pushed to choose sides. Of course, they lie all the time about this. Pezeshkian and Iran did call upon BRICS to play a role in stopping the conflict during their recent call with Modi in India, whose country serves as a rotating chair. But that was seen as a way to kickstart talks, peace talks, in Delhi. The Iranian foreign minister recently said that India is among several, quote, friendly nations allowed to transit the Straits of Hormuz. India, Russia, China, they did not betray Iran at any level whatsoever. Iran functions the way it does because of those countries. India is also permitted through the Red Sea. You know, the Houthis will not fire on them. They're not pushed to choose a side. They already have chosen a side. Now, it appears that the U.S., remember, sanctions, if you read my paper on sanctions, as bizarre as the laws are on this, I mean, this is something that has to go through Congress, but the president can suspend or waive sanctions at any time. So it has waived sanctions on both Russian and Iranian oil so that India, among others, can purchase oil to help stabilize the global market. But Iran has also tempered its hopes about BRICS in general. The only reason why Bloomberg wrote about this subject is due to the false premise that continues to proliferate about BRICS, supposedly being a security bloc or a political bloc. Why hasn't it supported Iran? Well, people who know, who understand what BRICS is really about, would not have expected anything like this. We got it from the SCO, but with time, the rest of the global public might wise up to this. Some might still remain delusional and in denial. That's the case within the American population itself. We have to remember the U.S., whether it likes it or not, is fading away. This defeat handed to them by the Iranians is a huge moment, no matter how it's spun here at home. That doesn't mean China or Russia are going to now expand. They have no desire for all these bases. I forget the total number of bases the U.S. has around the world. The huge expense They want allies. They don't want their own bases around the world. They do have, China has a few. Russia has one in Syria. But BRICS is a growing manifestation of the role that Beijing and Moscow, along with a few other states, in regards to their political orientation over the years. Yeah, it's a threat to the role of the U.S., you know, in general, the G7, whatever you want to call it. The U.S. cannot handle the fact that it can't directly participate in or impact the agendas. Russia was forced out of, or wisely exited, many international organizations, which I think was a great thing. It forced them to rebuild or even increase trading routes with China and India. You know, every era is an era of rapid geopolitical changes. There's nothing special about this one. Every era has rapid changes. They all say the same thing. Russia is central to the greater Eurasian Union, alongside many others, like the Collective Security Treaty, or the CSTO, as well as BRICS. Now, the CSTO, founded in 1992, is a mutual defense pact made up of Armenia, although their membership is frozen, from what I'm told, Belarus, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Russia, and Tajikistan. Clearly, Central Asia wants nothing to do with the regime. The Greater Eurasian Union focused on economic integration and supporting economic development among members. And is expected to build its structures, the method of functions by replicating the EU. BRICS, as it stands now, represents something like, 25% of the world's population? Oh, sorry, geographic area. About 3 billion people, 42% of the globe's population. The very first meeting of BRICS was in St. Petersburg in 2005. It was simply called RIC. There was no BRICS, just Russia, India, and China. Brazil, which is always a big if, subsequently South Africa joined later. That's why it has the name it has. Again, South Africa just stands out like a sore thumb. What they did with Israel in the international court, quote-unquote court, was nice. I like that. But that's about it. It's a third world hellhole. But I guess the concept was South Africa was a bridgehead to Africa. BRICS seems to be, they make a much better deal in Africa for their development agenda because they're not forcing, you know, the fag stuff and all the rest. I fear that if sanctions are totally canceled on Russia, then those handful of westernizers who are still in power will convince Putin to rejoin these, you know, the IMF and all the rest. Utter disaster for Russia. The point is, regional hegemons have to exist or emerge to provide an economic and security alternative to the Western-dominated idea or the liberal idea. It is certainly reasonable. China supported the BRICS Bank. If the countries offer an alternative vision that provides benefits to new members, well, maybe now it's a good time to show that BRICS members' relations between them or among them are an alternative to the format existing in the West. Right, you can't do that if you're bringing in the Western allies to them. So you have plans already, and of course, it's not going to go anywhere. But they're in store to expand the group to include Argentina, Turkey, Indonesia, a few African countries. Niger might be interesting because there's a lot of uranium there, and they're very pro-Russian there. I've dealt with that some other time. Yeah, their IQs might be not the highest in the world, but there are several strong military governments who are kicking the IMF out. But Moscow has always argued that the entrance ticket to the group is independence and sovereignty, i.e. nationalism. Not satellites of anybody. Those who want to join the group, in addition, Mexico, Indonesia, Turkey, Egypt, Iran. Iran should be a member immediately. But to be a member of BRICS and to remain a member of BRICS, you have to accept the core principles of the organization. Many of these countries right now do not. The U.S. could very easily use the UAE or the Saudis to spy on what's going on there, to influence it. Clearly, it's a terrible threat to them. In 2022, Russia's State Duma Speaker, Vyacheslav Volodin, wrote on Telegram that the U.S. and its allies are destroying economic ties by their sanctions policy, but at the same time creating new points of growth in other countries. Here's what he said. The move by Washington and its allies to cut the existing economic ties created new points of growth in the world. According to the Parliament Speaker, Western sanctions are leading the establishment of another group of eight nations, China, India, Russia, Indonesia, Brazil, Mexico, Iran, and Turkey. That's 24.4% ahead of the old group of developed countries in terms of gross domestic product. Purchasing power, PPP, of course. The U.S., with its own hands, has created the conditions for countries willing to build some kind of an equal dialogue and mutually beneficial relations and establish a new G8 group with Russia. All right, I don't know. New Mexico bothers me, given its president. If Suharto was still in Indonesia, it would be another matter. Iran should be given immediate new membership status. Turkey, now that would be something. Understandably, there is already a group of seven, the G7. Another aspect, probably still a part of the regime. It's an intergovernmental policy forum. Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, Britain, and the U.S. And of course, then there's the EU, as we all know. And even them, they claim to be organized around a shared value, which, of course, as we know, is nonsensical because they don't have values. Liberalism as far as they go. Thank God Russia has removed itself from that group. Now, that prompted Donald Trump's reiteration that Russia should be readmitted, trying to instigate a trade war with Russia. With China. Then increasing tensions with Iraq. This is what happened in 2019, the meeting in Biarritz in France, which was the most divided meeting of that group since it started. Now he rescinded his signature because of something that Justin Trudeau said. There was no communique coming out of the Biarritz conference for the G7. Russia says it has no relevance anymore. And they're non-industrialized powers, and they are saturated with debt. They don't produce things. They count financial derivatives as growth. They've been in a permanent depression for a very long time. There's a few people out there saying the new members should be Argentina, Egypt, Indonesia, Kazakhstan, Nigeria, UAE, Saudi Arabia, Senegal, and Thailand. In fact, the UAE, along with Bangladesh and Uyghur, became the first expansion members of BRICS, the National Development Bank, in 2024. But the timing made people cautious. The bank doesn't have a fixed location. It finally has it does have its headquarters in Shanghai, finally. And there's a regional office, for some reason, in South Africa, in Johannesburg. However long it's going to last, I don't know. But this is a great thing. The para-organizations, G7, G8 group, these are all, you know, being confronted with these other institutions. Remember, Vladimir Putin became a popular ruler. Well, same thing with Alexander Lukashenko, for that matter, because he threw out the IMF and the World Bank from the country. Then he paid Russia's debts early. Russia's debt now is only short-term, just because of the war and everything. It's a short-term debt. Every nation, that's like, you know, it's running like a small credit card balance. Russia is mostly a creditor nation. Yeah, the EU and the US had to seek their own development path, but their allies are brought in by force. The point is that there are new models being developed. I've been talking about for 30 years that liberalism is under attack the entire world over, as is Israel, thank God. The U.S. is seeing its dominance finally come to an end in the shortest empire, I think, maybe in world history. Like from 1946 to, you know, the Iran War, let's say. Or from 1946 to the Afghan War. However you want to put it. That's not very long. At some point, the U.S. will be forced to negotiate new models of international economic and other relations. And have new international treaties that ensure equality of all states. But they don't understand this. I don't think they'll ever understand this. Maybe the boomers are almost gone. That'll help, maybe. China and Russia have always existed in a symbiotic way. They've been allies for many centuries now, actually. People don't know about that. It's not just being opposed to the U.S. Unipolarity. They've had many reasons to be allies for a long time. The Russo-Japanese War, which the Russians neither won nor lost, was partially based on this. Let's make it clear. China has the largest economy in the world. It was just a purchasing power parity, but now it's also in nominal terms. China is the world's largest exporter and the second largest importer of goods. 20% of the world's wealth is held in China. It has the world's largest banking sector under state control. The assets are about $40 trillion. The world's top four largest banks are all in China. And I don't know if this is good or bad, but in 2019, China overtook the U.S. as a home, the highest number of wealthy people in the world. Um, It's the highest number of rich people in the world, top 10% of wealth since 2019. There were 658 Chinese billionaires and 3.5 million millionaires. And of course, it's also a creditor country. And I haven't yet mentioned the Belt and Road. Yet another semi-institution that's already expanded significantly over the last 10 years. It includes 100 countries and many other international organizations. The U.S. is not one of them. NATO is not one of them. This is precisely where we are. Now, for the next 15 minutes, I want to change topics a little bit. It's not a radical change in topics, but let's face it, since it's always been difficult to speak like this, to speak freely, to speak the truth. The U.S. always had the Sedition Acts, or had the Sedition Acts of 1798. Criminalized statements against the U.S. government in wartime. From my favorite president, that was John Adams. It's a shame. But President Jefferson got most of it repealed. President Lincoln, 1865, had a de facto sedition act. All mostly executive orders, military directives, martial law, suspension of habeas corpus. At one time, Lincoln had 300 northern newspaper editors in prison. The stuff we're dealing with right now isn't really new. But back then, the U.S. was not an empire. 1918, Congress passed a new Sedition Act that applied when the U.S. government was at war. Prohibited speech and opinion that put the U.S. government and its war effort in a bad light. Donald Trump did something very similar. He has his own Sedition Act. Not by Congress so much. It seems to be an irrelevant institution anymore. But from his personal defense lawyer, currently serving as a U.S. Attorney General. It's unique. It protects from criticism not the U.S. government, but a foreign government, the Israeli government. It was a May 19 press release. May 19 this year, was a press release of the Department of Justice that says, President Trump has made clear that this administration will not tolerate anti-Semitism, and the Department of Justice is committed to implementing that directive. Donald Trump must see the writing on the wall, that everything is changing, and it's a good change. But his obsession with Israel has already destroyed his presidency, no matter what else he does. No matter what else he does, it's been ruined completely. In other words, U.S. Justice Department is now the protector of Israel. As is the U.S. military, the U.S. taxpayers, which has changed the way that we interact with Jews. And Jews should be told, you don't get to talk to us this way anymore. Men are dying in these bases over there solely for your protection. Shut up. Israel's interference in tenure decisions in many U.S. universities. And hiring contracting policies in state governments in Texas and Florida. And, of course, Israel's financing of the primary defeat of the U.S. Representative Tom Massie. Israel's assassination of foreign leaders. Israel's I also think they killed Charlie Kirk. I think they were involved in 9/11. Whoever it might be. Every thought, question, statement, or fact that can be attributed as hostile to Israel has been called now anti-Semitism and will not be tolerated by the Justice Department. The Trump regime is a Zionist regime. And truth is no defense. Washington Post published something on, that was on May 21st, on Trump silencing late night TV hosts. Well, come on. I don't know how many people even watch those anymore. They'll be silencing themselves pretty soon. CBS canceled Stephen Colbert. Seth Meyers and Jimmy Kimmel, I believe they're on the list. Yeah, you know, their whole agenda is, they're not funny. Their whole agenda is being anti-Trump, and it's not because of Israel necessarily. It's for domestic matters. During the 1980s and most of the 1990s, I don't know. You may have had articles that were permitted in big newspapers like that, you know, anti-Israel articles at the time. Today, that's not the case. U.S. Now, and we're talking about the BRICS and everything else being a new model. We're talking about this kind of thing, too. The U.S. has a president who goes to war at the request of his most important campaign contributor without any authorization of Congress, so long as it's on Israel's behalf. A legal advisor to the U.S. Department of State, Reid Rubenstein, has written a justification for Trump's military attack on Iran, which states that the U.S. initiated its military campaign, or Operation Epic Fury, quote, at the request of and in the collective self-defense of its Israeli ally. Okay. There's now an official statement that this exists solely for Israel and solely for Jews. Of course, the State Department defines aggression as self-defense. Israel has been doing that for a long time, too. Under President Trump, the U.S. now commits its dwindling resources, the lives of its military men, not personnel, it's men, the achievement of the greater Israel. Again, that changes how we interact with Jews. Thank God I don't have to do it very much. It's also one of the reasons I'm not on Facebook. I can't deal, you know. I've had many Jewish friends over the years, but they're not in a position of authority like they used to be. Now, here we have the U.S. government officially admitting that the only reason this is going on is that the Israelis demanded it. I want you to remember one thing from this talk. Please, don't take any casualty figures the U.S. puts out seriously. Please don't. Or, for that matter, the number of people who were killed in Gaza. Don't take that seriously. U.S. casualty figures are an absolute joke. The Iranians wiped out the forward bases, the U.S. military, throughout the Gulf states. At any given time, there's, 30,000 men there? That means there's a lot of dead Americans, unfortunately. So you say to the Jew who lectures you, you don't get to talk to me that way anymore. We are at a point that I never thought we'd be. Israel has helped destroy the Western liberal model. Remember, Israeli policy, that's considered fully democratic. Israel and Ukraine, despite the way that they function, 100% democratic. That's how they define democracy. It's a violent totalitarian system. So the attempt is, now I never, as you know, I've never tried to coat myself in First Amendment language. I say what I say because it's true, not because I have a legal right to say it. However, the First Amendment has permitted us, Americans, great more freedom than it has people elsewhere. I know I'm doing this solo today, but I'm very, very proud to be close friends with Sven Longshanks, who went to prison for 2 years for nothing. I still can't figure out what exactly it was. It was so minor. You know, a crime has to have an intent. It has to have damages. It has to have a victim. None of that exists here. I remember my wife used to say, look on your face when he was convicted, on my face when he was convicted. I was, and then sent to prison. I was shocked beyond belief. It wasn't even anything he said. They tried to shut down Radio Albion. And while he was in prison, Grandpa Dan and I ran it, which had to have destroyed their, you know, had to have made them miserable. Which is another way of saying that Radio Albion is important. People plagiarize from all of us all the time, right-wingers in general. Now, don't go too far and say, oh, yeah, they've canceled the First Amendment. But one of the things that happened during COVID was that people got used to totally arbitrary rule. When COVID was going on, I mean, I never traveled so much in my life. That's when I met my wife. We went all over the place. I didn't wear a mask. You know, got into a couple of fights, but that was it. That's what I do. People got used to, and Congress wasn't sitting, of course. The court wasn't sitting. So everything was a matter of executive orders, and that included the state level. We went to restaurants who refused to shut down. As it turns out, as I stated at the time, restaurants who didn't shut down, anyone got any sanctions at the time? Courts have completely reversed them because they violated no law. A decree isn't a law. There's nothing in the emergency legislation, the state or the federal government, that gives the U.S. government the power to do what they did. I love the fact that I was flouting it. I was all over the place. Again, I'm a homebody now, but I've never traveled more in my entire life. Americans got used to the rule by decree. No one comes close to Donald Trump's number of executive orders. I have a paper on that too. Go to my Patreon. But executive orders exist for a way to allow existing law to work out better. That's what it's for. Existing law, there's issues with it. Executive order can fix that. That's all it is. That's why it was hardly ever used prior to recent. Now, an executive order is stuff that could never be passed by any Congress anytime. You know, JFK created the affirmative action idea by executive order. No one's going to pass that. That's what executive orders are. They're ways to promote things that in no way will ever become law. And I know restaurateurs, friends around here who did shut down or who reopened early or something like that. They were terrified. I said, what are you terrified of? And it's true. Everybody that I know who was, and I've read about it myself too, anybody who was sanctioned for going against these decrees, all that has been reversed, as I predicted, because these aren't laws in any normal sense of the word. Arbitrary decrees are not laws. No, there was no legislative foundation here whatsoever. So because of that, it seems, as I've already said, the U.S. Congress seems to be irrelevant anymore. But executive order cannot override the First Amendment, and it won't. It just told the world what really matters to him. But this is the very model, the very concept that Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the SCO, all the rest, exists to fight. No one in the SCO has any illusions about the Jews. Certainly not in Russia, certainly not in China. The banking system in China is state-controlled. And there are a few private sector banks, that's true. The central bank is state-controlled. And Russia is the same thing. It's actually a long story as to how that came about. We started off by talking about BRICS as simply bringing in new members who might not be in agreement with it, or even worse, may just be plants by the U.S. That's how these things are brought down, and it can't be done. Iran should be a member, certainly. I've said that before. But Saudi Arabia, the UAE, very much not sure. But my friends, we're living in an amazing age. And I have to thank God for it. It's the result of so much of our work, including your own, by supporting people like me over the decades. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And I will talk to you again next week. Bye-bye.